WGXC underwriting support is provided by Hudson River Tattoo, providing custom tattoos and piercing with over 20 years of experience. Located at 724 Warren Street in Hudson, Hudson River Tattoo is open Wednesday through Sunday, 1 to 8 p.m., with both appointments and walk-in services available. For more information, call 518-828-5182 or visit HudsonRiverTattoo.com or search Hudson River Tattoo on Facebook.
Listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be if I...
Hello. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. Today's show is going to cover the themes of juvenile justice, as well as the International Dinner. The International Dinner is an event that takes place annually in Hudson, New York, as an opportunity for different cultures to come together and share food, as well as music and stories and dance. And this year, this event took place in Hudson and shared the issues of prisons and social justice and alternatives to violence. So before we go to a clip about that, let's start off with a little music. This is Wetete Mare by the Ethiopiques.
Shallow, Kerbin Wagger, Escaziota baking, now got a tedare, what a temare. Alemachin tita, umbrella who betelling ye, Sahaya touch me there, you want a chimaselling, can't ye other ye baker, the coping ye calipe, Cassita dragonial, who betin it a rape. What a temare, እመጣልሻለሁ ቅርብ ነው አገሬ እስከዚያው ጠብቂኝ ናፍቆቴ ዳሬ ኧረ ወተቴ ማሬ ካለሽበት አገሬ ልቤ ያስታወሰ የሐሳብ ፈረሶን ጭኖ ገሰገሰ ፋትማታ ባይኔ ላይ ደቀን በማለትሽ እራሴን ልስት ነው ወፈፍ አርጎኝ ፍቅርሽ ኧረ ወተቴ ማሬ ኧረ ወተቴ ማሬ እመጣልሻለሁ ቅርብ ነው አገሬ እስከዚያው ጠብቂኝ ናፍቆቴ ትዳሬ ኧረ ወተቴ ማሬ እንግዳው ፍቅራችን ያለሸኝ ሄደ ያንን ሁሉ መንገድ ቆርጦ ተራመደ አንቺ በመሆንሽ የፍቅር መቤቴ ጠብቅኝ መጣለሁ ትዳሬን አፍቆቴ.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. I'm going to play a clip now from Hudson's International Dinner, which this year focused on criminal justice system, specifically alternatives to violence, as well as juvenile justice. So speakers in this next clip include Carlene Murphy, Carolyn Polycarpus from the Reentry Task Force of Columbia County, Joni Hunt, who's a volunteer in the Alternatives to Violence program, as well as Jacinta Keith, Quentin Cross, and Cedric Fulton from the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center. As you listen to this clip, it will segue into the next focus of the show, which is on juvenile justice. So you'll hear discussion of the prison system, various issues surrounding it, and then a need to look at juvenile justice. So here is a clip I produced on the International Dinner that took place in Hudson, New York. International Community Dinner is an annual event held at the First Presbyterian Church on Warren Street in Hudson. This year, the pre-dinner program focused on social justice and alternatives to violence. Carolyn Polycarpus of the Reentry Task Force of Columbia County spoke about the alternatives to violence programs that she, along with many others, facilitate in Green Correctional Facility.
So the workshop started out in prison. They are now in, I think it's 18 prisons in New York State. But there are also community workshops. It's done, can be done in schools. There are youth workshops. There's a specific youth manual. There are support groups, both in the prison and on the outside. And the wonderful thing about it is it's very flexible so that you can always put it together in a way that will work almost anywhere. I'm right now working to put together a program that we could do in the Columbia County Jail.
Joni Hunt, a volunteer facilitator of AVP, had just come from a workshop that morning.
Okay, so now we're going to actually do some AVP exercises as a group. I'll just share a brief example of a light and lively because we're not doing one today. This morning, one of the guys in the group decided to do a light and lively where the whole group sings Mary Has a Little Lamb in unison. You can only imagine, right? So things like that, but it's a lot of fun and it really brings people out of their shells and allows them to be who they are in that space, and it's a wonderful thing.
Community members partnered up and shared stories about types of discrimination that they had faced in their lives and about things that they would like to see change in their community. Following the exercises, Carlene Murphy spoke about prisons.
This issue has been in the forefront of the Presbyterian Church for a long time. And one of the things that I can briefly bring to your attention is that In this booklet here, there is a resolution calling for the abolition of for-profit private prisons. And the church, from the beginning, and he said that here, showed his concern for prisoners have been established for almost a century. In 1910, the General Assembly declared that the church ought to stand for the development of a Christian spirit and the attitude of society toward offenders against the law. And this policy, the church believe that the ultimate goal of the criminal justice system should be restorative justice.
Despite there being no private prisons in New York State, the campaign against for-profit prisons is one of the top priorities of the Presbyterian Church at the national level. Inspired by the topic, Jacinta Keith responded to the logic behind private prisons and connected it to the larger issues of corporate power in society.
My name is Jacinta Keith, and I'm the wife of Stanley B. Keith. And I normally don't get up in public and talk, but what I just heard is so succinct to what's going on in this United States of America. And it's not only with prisoners, it's with what the agenda the corporations have for America. Because we need to get informed for us to act. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves repeating our history, and where people will own our minds, own what we do, and own what we own. And we have to be our own people, involve ourselves in our communities, involve ourselves in listening to the correct version of the news versus the watered down or the dumb and dumb of America that's going on right now in the news factor, in the news media. And they usually say, follow the money. And the money is being held and supported by, and all these actions are by corporations, including our great Walmart that is down there on Fairview Avenue. What corporations are doing to America, well, besides owning our legislators, sad to say, Democrats and Republicans, they're all in the same soup at this point from my point of view, is that I worked in the juvenile system for 21 years. I've worked with the state now in daycare licensing, but I began at South Lansing Center in Ithaca, New York. That's where I began in the juvenile system. So I can talk a little, and I understand, and I hear what you're saying, and it is so true. The Koch brothers, the Walmarts, the barons, the money barons of America are controlling our lives. And we need to wake up, America, because cheap labor is the meaning of today's actions. They are going to use or privatize prisons to get cheap labor, extend sentences so that they don't have to pay them health benefits, because, of course, whatever health benefit they get, they get. There's no overseeing of services to these young men. They're not really being educated. They just tell, you have to do this, boom, 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 and that's it. So all of this stuff is geared to make money, because that's what these corporations want. They want to fill their bottom line. They up, and they don't care by whatever means necessary. They are going to do it.
Members of the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center spoke to the broader mission, and they zeroed in on the issue of youth incarceration and juvenile justice and its impact on young people and the community at large.
Good afternoon. My name is Quentin Cross, and I'm the chairman and president of the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center. Our mission is to provide opportunities for black men to become leaders through empowerment, community service, and advocacy. With us today, we have our vice chair, Alexis B. Keith, back there, and the wife of Stella Keith, our namesake, Ms. Jacinta Keith, and Jaylee Keith in the back there, board members, KJ Gray is here with us, our program chair, Cedric Pullen, and our community service chair, Tiffany Garriga. I've been thinking about this, not a lot, but it was on my spirit pretty much all day today. And it's what I want to talk about from my piece. Is why black males and why black males' achievement. Well, first, a friend of mine would say, historically, black men and boys have been the most marginalized in our country. Miss Joni Hunt would have said that. Joyful joining. Here in Hudson, for the most part, black men and boys have been excluded from economic, social, education, and political life. We believe that the civil rights movement has never made it this far up the river. And to most, the movement is more than 200 years old. We would believe that there is still much of the American dream that eludes us. Why black male achievement? Because 1 in 4 black students are suspended, mostly for nonviolent offenses. Why black male achievement? Because Hudson City School District only graduates 49% of their students of African American descent. Why black male achievement? Because the prison industrial complex is still alive and well. Why black male achievement? Because black males make up 35.4% of the jail and prison population, even though we only make up less than 16% of the overall U.S. population. Why black male achievement? Because the graduation rate for black males is only 52% nationwide, while our dropout rate is 8.7%. Why black male achievement? Because 1 in 3 black men can expect to be in prison in their lifetime. That's why we're here. That is our focus. That is our goal. We ask that you join us in this movement as we try to make our community, we got smart, start small, start somewhere, a better place. 1 in 3 black males can expect to be incarcerated. That is a crazy dynamic. That is something that we should really think about. As we're in a church house, my Bible reads, what you do to the least of these, you do to me. That's what Jesus said. I just ask that you think about that as I turn it over to my brother, Cedric Fulton. Thank you for your time.
My children, I can't even imagine, you know, my children going through the least bit of pain, the least bit of sorrow. I can't imagine anyone's children going through the least bit of pain and the least bit of sorrow. And I want to talk to you today about youth incarceration. You know, I'm a formerly incarcerated individual, and, you know, it going through that experience put a fire in me to prevent any of our youth to become incarcerated. I want to talk about the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. The system that is currently operational in the United States was created under the 1974 Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. The Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act called for deinstitutionalization of juvenile delinquents. It requires that states holding youth within adult prisons for status offenses remove them within a span of 2 years. This time frame was adjusted over time. Status offenses are offenses like the use of tobacco, running away from home, you know, things like that. You know, things that as an adult they wouldn't be incarcerated for. Criminal justice, and in particular juvenile justice, reform battles are often fought in the court of public opinion. The popular news media have played a crucial role in promoting the myth of a new generation of young super predators threatening the public. Despite documented decreases in youth crime, especially in violent crime, indicating a 68% decline in youth homicide in the 1990s, overall media coverage of youth crime is increasing. Despite evidence to the contrary, 62% of respondents to a survey on youth delinquency believe that youth crime was up. Minority youth are disproportionately represented in the incarcerated populations relative to their representation in the general population. A recent report from the National Council on Crime and Delinquency found that minority youth are treated more severely than white youth at every point of contact within the system. From arrest to detention to adjudication to incarceration, even when charged with the same crime. In 1995, African American youth made up 12% of the population, but were arrested at rates double those for Caucasian youth.
I just want to make a statement that New York State is one of 2 states in the nation that tries 16-year-olds as adults. I think that's really important for us to remember. We often think about New York State as being sort of progressive compared to some other states, but us in North Carolina are the only 2 states in the country that consider 16-year-olds adults in the criminal justice system.
Following the activities and speakers, nearly 100 community members shared a meal with dishes from all over the world, and performers played music and danced. The event demonstrated that people in diverse communities throughout Hudson are concerned with the impact of prisons on our youth and communities, and that there is a strong desire to build multiracial and multicultural movements to make changes in the prison system. From Hudson, New York, I am Corey Fisher Hoffman with the Prison Voices Project on WGXC.
Si la cosa suena como estás pensando, no veo pretexto para estar hablando. La banda ya llegó.
From the banner, sí, sí. Bajo paso y pongo a todos mi en frecuencia. Yo hace rato busco esto pa' ponerte bueno. Yo hace rato busco esto pa' ponerte a ti. De lo mío, de lo tuyo, pa' que te enteres de lo mío. Pa' ti, esto pa' te hacer es que yo ni te lo vendo, ni te lo presto, ni lo regalo. Boris es lo que trae, es un nuevo flow. Me hace palo, palo. Toma esto que te traigo, que esto es bueno. Esto que traemos ritmo fresco, no con bota. Así que bota de mi boca loca tú esa nota. Toda esa gente que en mi ritmo se sofoca.
Distinto by the Orishas, Cuban hip-hop. You are listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC Community Radio, and after listening to that clip again on the International Dinner that took place in Hudson, New York, and focused on themes of criminal justice and the prison system, it was interesting for me to hear, and this will be a reoccurring theme in today's show around juvenile justice, just the importance of the media and the power that the media has in shaping public images around crime, and specifically around juvenile justice. And so as Cedric Fulton from the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center mentioned when he was speaking, that a lot of policies around juvenile justice get formed around public opinion, and that public opinion oftentimes is built through how the media portrays and covers issues of crime. And that will also be featured as I move on to the next segment of today's show, talking about juvenile justice. So as was mentioned by Joni Hunt, New York State has some of the harshest approaches to young people who commit crimes in the country, allowing teenagers as young as 13 to be given adult-level penalties. So as she said, in New York State, as well as in North Carolina, the only two states in the country, 16-year-olds can be tried as adults. But also young teenagers, even as young as 13, depending on the kind of crime, like if they are convicted of murder, can actually have adult-level penalties. Now, this is contrary to the whole history of setting up a juvenile justice system, which was based on the idea that people who are not yet adults in the eyes of the laws of the law should not answer in the same way to decisions that they make as children or as young people in the same way that adults do. So today we're going to hear a little bit more about the effects of these laws, including the stories of a young person who spent several years incarcerated at a residential facility in Claverack. And we're also going to hear from a parent of a young person who has spent most of his adolescence behind bars. During this show, you'll learn more about ways New York's juvenile justice laws work, how they punish young people, and what you can do to help with these laws. So make sure you stay tuned till the end of the program when it tells you what organizations are doing work around this and how to get involved. So this program was the next part of the clips that I'm going to show were produced by Prison Voices Project collaborators Jeremy Thal and Alexandra Cox. Originally, this piece aired in August of 2011, and I edited it slightly just so that it would continue on with the theme that was brought up in Hudson around juvenile justice. And it's also a continuing theme and conversation that's taking place here in Hudson. Tomorrow, Friday, May 10th, the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center will continue with Time and Space Limited, their Time to Talk conversation that will take place at TSL, Time and Space Limited, at 434 Columbia Street. That's tomorrow evening, Friday, May 10th at 6:30 p.m. It will be a continuation of their conversations around juvenile justice systems, mostly that have focused in the past on PINS, the person in need of supervision, which I've covered here at the Prison Voices Project. This panel will host Honorable Richard Kowick from Columbia County Family Court Judge, Honorable John Connor, who's a Hudson City Court Judge, and Mr. Lee Wynn, former Director of Office of Children and Family Services, as well as from the Tyrone Facility for Boys. So the topic will continue to touch on juvenile justice and restorative justice. There is a potluck event that will begin at 6:30 p.m., and the conversation will take place at 7. That's tomorrow evening, Friday, May 10th at 6:30 p.m. at Time and Space Limited, 434 Columbia Street. So continuing with our coverage here of juvenile justice on the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Coxsackie, Green, Brookwood, Claverack. Here we go. More on the juvenile justice system.
He wrote me a letter. And he told me he was sorry for him being away so long. And I had to tell him it's not your fault. He said, I had to grow up and, you know, incarcerated. He's been incarcerated ever since the age of 14, and he's 19 now, and he'll be almost 20 when he come home. And that's a long time for me, and yeah, I'm just be depressed a lot because I miss my son. It's like he had to raise himself in jail. It's hard. It's real hard. And I miss my son. And now I have another one that is going through the same thing.
Prior to 1978, the cases of all children under 16 years of age, regardless of the severity of the crime, were exclusively within the jurisdiction of the family court, where they could be placed for no more if they were found guilty of the offense, where they would be adjudicated juvenile delinquents and placed for no more than 5 years or until they reached the age of 21. But in any event, the end result of that was they would not be criminalized. They would be considered juvenile delinquents. And this was even for the crime of murder. And that's how Willie Boskett's case became such a sensational one, an extraordinary one, and really was the basis for politicians and the public through the media's attention to the Willie Boskett case, because Willie Boskett murdered two people before he reached the age of 16. And when the public became aware, now wait a minute, now Willie Boskett is going to go into the family court?
Retired Judge Michael Corriero runs an organization devoted to treating children as children in New York's court system. He was a judge in the New York State Courts for 28 years.
So Willie Boskett precipitated the enactment of New York's juvenile offender law. And that law essentially criminalized 13, 14, and 15-year-olds for behavior that prior to 1978 would have been considered delinquent behavior and would have subjected them to the therapeutic interventions available in the family court. And instead, now these children were going into an adult court, which was ill-equipped to deal with the developmental differences of children and had very little flexibility in terms of therapeutic interventions that were available through the family court.
We spoke with Nancy Ginsberg, who is the director of the Adolescent Intervention and Diversion Team at New York City's Legal Aid Society, the city's largest public defender agency. Nancy's team represents young people charged as adults.
The vast, vast majority of the crimes charged are robberies in the first or second degree, and those are usually robberies with weapons or physical injury, caused almost always by a group of kids acting together. The kids in the city tend to come from the same neighborhoods, very underserviced, poor neighborhoods. There are a number of neighborhoods in each county that tend to feed the system. Many of our kids have mental health issues and learning disabilities, emotional disturbances. They have fractured family structures. And the vast, vast majority of the kids are kids of color.
My crime, personally, my crime was I went to the store, but I had a BB gun. Mm. I didn't have a real gun. I had a BB gun. You know, it looked real, and the purpose of it, the intent of it, was to be used as a, you know, to be perceived as a real gun, but it wasn't real. But I got charged with a robbery. Originally, I got charged with robbery in the first degree, armed robbery, I mean, in the first degree. You know what I mean?
James is now 19 years old. He was arrested when he was just 15. He was sent to Brookwood, a 180-bed secure residential facility for 13, 14, and 15-year-olds charged as adults, or so-called juvenile offenders, who are charged under the law which Judge Corriero previously described. The facility is located in Columbia County. James describes a day in the life of the facility.
You know, you wake up, you go to class, learn nothing. Yeah, after that, you may go to gym, but, you know, it's not really much. It's about 45 minutes or so of, you know, whatever you choose to do. And go back on the wing, you know, you watch TV or playing cards or, you know, just have a lot of free time, just sitting, you know, doing nothing. Or, you know, if that, and that's only if they choose to let you do that. Because they can, you know, and they have just kept you in a cell where you're just looking out the window, you know, sitting on your bed, sleeping, or whatever the case is, you know, doing nothing except thinking about how you're gonna, you know, the negative things you're gonna do when you come out. Because, you know, when you're locked in a cell, you're like, you know, why do I care? Why should I not do negative things? I'm already in a cell, you know what I mean? It's just, this is boring. I'd rather have some action. Let me go outside. Let me start a fight. You know, let me get everybody going crazy. This is gonna be fun, you know? That's the things that you know, residents think about, because they feel like if you're gonna, you know, force them to do nothing, then they'll make something happen, you know. But I feel like if they were all the time, 100% of the time, active and, you know, their time was occupied with other things, they wouldn't have time to think about negative things to do, because they'll be playing sports, you know, whatever, basketball, baseball, football, you know, football at 1, baseball at 3, soccer at 6, whatever it is, you know, and then, you know, maybe a movie at 8, whole days occupied, so at the end of the day, you're just tired, you're ready to go to sleep, you know, you're not thinking about anything else, you know, but don't, relax people so they can have the energy to just wild out all day. You know what I mean? Which is what happened. You know, I remember times when 10 o'clock at night, when the A-Rest was going to sleep, he would start banging on their doors, you know, and going crazy, cursing, yelling. They're full of energy. You know, they don't, you know, they don't have nothing to do. And that's how it was.
Pam has seen both of her sons and her husband go behind bars. All three of them were charged as juvenile offenders. Pam lives in Harlem, where she raises her family and attends college.
This is a mop. First of all, you just throw them in jail instead of trying to help them. Maybe you could send them to a program. Maybe they can get therapy. Maybe they just need someone to talk to. I don't think jail is the outcome of everything. I really don't. I see a lot of young people go in and they come out worse than what they were. I think that's what makes you a bad person. I really do. I mean, sometimes you have to give a person a chance. Sometimes it could be a mistake.
Elsie Chandler is a senior trial attorney at the Neighborhood Defender Service of Harlem, a community-based defender office. She runs the Youth Law Project there, which focuses on providing high-quality legal representation to young people charged with crimes. Much of her work is with young people charged as adults. She is also a licensed clinical psychologist. She has been working in Harlem for over 40 years.
Any prison is inherently stultifying, inherently dehumanizing, brutalizing. It's just in the nature of the institution. And I know that there are some people who work in prisons and in juvenile facilities who are remarkable human beings. I've met them, I've talked to them, I know that that happens. But I'm saying that institutionally, it's not good.
A 2009 study by the Office of Children and Family Services, or OCFS, the state agency responsible for providing residential treatment for young people adjudicated as juvenile delinquents and charged as juvenile offenders, revealed that 89% of the young men released from OCFS custody were rearrested by the age of 28.
Because the recidivism rate, as far as I know when I was in there, was 85%. And in my 2.5 years there, I seen, you know, people go home, violate parole, violate probation, come back. You know, it's like a cycle because, you know, they come out. When they're sent out, they're sent out with nothing. You understand what I'm saying? They may CRL, max out, or whatever the case is, CR out, and they're on the street, but they don't have no job. They don't have no, you know, they don't have no resources to help them with a job. They have no resources to help them with school. They basically said, okay, you just spent 2 years here. Now try again. You know, and, it, you know, it's going to fail. Because you don't, you know, you're basically going from an environment where you have no freedom to an environment where you have all, you know, all the freedom you need. You know, and even me as myself, even with all I had, I found it difficult. You know, they gave me a ticket. I still have my ticket, you know, for the Amtrak. You know, and I'm like, that this ticket is just a ticket to some people. But to me, it's like, this day I came home, this day they put me on the train on my own to, you know, try again. So, you know, but I knew that try again, I wasn't going to fail. You know, I'm going to try again and I'm going to succeed, you know, and, but I started that ticket and, you know, I'm thinking to myself, like, I may be able to succeed with this kind of situation, you know, because I feel like I'm a strong individual, you know, who has basically been on my own mostly all my life. So I'm prepared for it. You know, I've always been independent, but not many people know how to be independent. You know, they always, if they don't have somebody, they're going to fail. So, you know, I feel like, you know, I understand when people come out, they don't have nothing, why they fail.
Young people who are charged as adults often face a term on adult parole after they've been released on custody. This often means that they're on parole when they're as young as 15 years old. Young people who are released onto parole typically have a nightly curfew and are expected to participate in a variety of substance abuse and anger management programs. However, parole officers in New York are notorious for their focus on surveillance and monitoring, not on support and care.
Parole, okay, parole I feel is no help at all because I came home on parole. All parole did for me was come to my house a couple times a week, maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, 6 a.m, wake me up just to see if I'm home and leave. Then, you know, at first when I came home, I had to report to the office every week, then every 2 weeks, then every month. And they would give me a urine test, see if I'm clean. Have a nice day. You know, that's basically it.
Pam's oldest son spent time in a secure residential facility operated by OCFS and was released onto parole when he was just 15 years old. He was rearrested just a few short months later.
I have a son that's in Green Correctional Facility now. But my experience with parole when he first came home, it was unfair to me. It was unfair. They didn't explain nothing to my son. He was only 15 when he came home. He was on adult parole. And they treated him like he was an adult. You know, they just threw him out there in the streets. Around my area where I live, it is so bad. It is so bad. Police harass you all the time around here. He came home, the day he came home, he went to the store, and he was harassed the same day. He came outside, maybe like 5 days after he was home. He got arrested because he was on a bike on the corner. They violated him. They said he was with the gang around here, which he was going to know anything about what was going on around here. So when he came home, it's like they just sweep him up. So now my son is incarcerated again.
That was the first clip produced by Alexandra Cox and Jeremy Thal about juvenile justice in New York State. And just as a specific shout out to young people who are currently locked up, Mother's Day is coming around the corner, is on Sunday, and also to the many women who are in prison, who are mothers, and who won't be with their children this time around. So here's a song for you all.
How sweet and happy seem the days of which I dream. Memories I recall now and then. And with what rapture sweet my worried heart would be. If I could only hear my mother pray again. If I could only hear my mother pray again. If I could hear her sweet tender voice then, how happy I would be.
It would mean so much
to me.
If I could hear my mother pray again around the old home place, her cherishing smiling face was always bringing comfort, hope, and cheer. And she used to sing to her eternal king,
it was the sound I love to hear. If I could only hear my mother pray again. If I could hear her sweet, tender voice then, how happy I would be. It would mean so much to me. If I could hear my mother pray again. She used to pray that I on Jesus would rely and always walk the shining gospel way. Her work on earth is done. Her life's crown has been won. And now she's at rest with him above. If I could only...
That was If I Could Only Hear My Mother Pray Again by Ben Harper. So you're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. We are here in Hudson, New York at the studio. And this radio station has a coverage range that includes a number of correctional facilities. So within listening range is Coxsackie Correctional Facility, Brookwood Youth Detention Center, which is the secure facility that was just mentioned by the young person interviewed in this program, as well as Green Correctional Facility, so one of the children of the woman interviewed. Her child is in Green Correctional Facility, so that's also within listening range. And the Prison Voices Project gets letters from people who are inside of those facilities. So last show, I read a letter for a request to do a show on felony disenfranchisement and voter rights. And so just as a shout out to the person who wrote that letter in Coxsackie Correctional Facility, I've already begun my research and I will announce good in advance and write you a letter and let you know when that show is going to air. But I'm doing more research on people who are incarcerated losing. Right now we're talking about juvenile justice. And I will continue with a piece that was produced by Alexandra Cox and Jeremy Thal, who are collaborators of the Prison Voices Project. And so here is the last part of their piece that they produced on juvenile justice. Thanks for tuning in to WGXC 90.7 FM or streaming live at WGXC.org.
So let's say City of New York gave you $1 million to help kids that kind of from in similar situations that you were when you were, say, 13, 14, 15, what would you do with that $1 million?
The first thing I would do is I would look at a lot of people that were in my situation that I know, you know, as far as the people I know right now that are successful, I would get them together. Then I would ask them to get people they know, and I would just do extensive research on people who have been locked up for robbery, people locked up for murder, people locked up for different types of things, and who are home now successfully with doing these things as a youth, you know, and they made it. And I would want them to be with me working on, you know, different ideas, you know, because I don't know everything, and I don't have, you know, one thing that I know, someone else may not, but they might know a lot more than I don't, and their ideas may be a lot better than mine. So I feel like if you put in a room all, you know, let's say 21-year-olds, 22-year-olds, whatever it is, 23-year-olds, all, you know, youth that went through these experiences for different crimes, you know, they know what it's like, they know how they were treated, they know what could have been better, they know what could have been worse, they know what it is. If you put them together and just everybody's brains just work together, then I feel like, you know, that would be the main ingredient, you know, the main recipe to what works. You know, what would be the ideal plan to help youths? Because, like I said, I can't think of what would help because I, you know, I haven't been charged with everything. I don't know how every, you know, every crime, what the time is. I don't know how you're treated if you do this, if you do that. I just know my crime, robbery. You know, I want to speak to somebody who's been locked up for murder. I want to see, you know, what they feel like. You know, what was their situation? Somebody, you know, that was locked up, you know, for assault or criminal possession of a gun. Why were you holding a gun? You know, were you scared? There wasn't enough protection for you in your environment? You know, what is it? So I feel like if you put all these people in one room, that's what I would do. The first thing is that $1 million, I'd be like, listen, I'm paying you. Get your ass over here. Let's work on this. This is what we need to do. You know what I mean? It would be like a foundation, you know. You know, who knows? I might call it the recipe. You know, whatever it is. That would be the foundation to, you know, starting what works, or it could be called what works, you know what I mean?
What should be done? We asked everyone what they thought were our obligations to young people under these laws in New York.
I think that we have to mount a campaign to have our public officials appreciate the enormity of this issue and its impact on New York children. We recognize that the great weight of these laws that criminalize young people under 18 years that fall most often on the poor and the vulnerable in our communities throughout the state. And yet, I don't believe that legislators who are otherwise sensitive to the economic issues that the barriers created by these laws, as well as recognizing the true value of children in our society.
We live in a very brutal society, and a society where the predominant culture is violent, not just the subculture that the young adults that I represent live in, but the predominant culture is violent. I'm not talking about just movies and video games. I'm talking about, after all, we live in a society right now that's waging war in multiple areas all over the world. This kind of society, this kind of violence, economic violence, the stark contrast in some people being enormously rich and the bulk of people being increasingly poor, losing their homes, losing their jobs, not being able to find a job that gives you a living wage, even if you do find a job. These are violences that we all live with. And children suffer the most, actually. Children suffer when their parents suffer. Children suffer the uncertainty, the fear, hunger, deprivations of poverty. Children suffer. And if you grow up suffering and being brutalized, that's what you learn. You become an angry person, a person filled with despair, a person who doesn't always act with empathy towards the next person. It's not just, for example, my client that might lack empathy. It's the state that lacks empathy. We are actually, all of us in this, a community of victims. It's very bad for, it's very humanly unsatisfying for the prosecution and for the court to lack empathy towards my clients, just as it is bad for my clients to lack empathy towards, let's say, the person whose bicycle they're taking.
Several months ago, James was asked to give a speech at his foster care agency. He read from a paper that he wrote for college, for which he received an A.
Exiting the elementary school backyard to walk home, the sight of fellow students running into their parents' arms was a yearning unfillable for me. During award ceremonies, families made up of a mother, father, brother, sister, and baby were always present, clapping and representing support to their loved ones. Standing alone, my eyes were stuck on the empty seat in the back row. A coldness struck my heart and tears overcame my eyes. Moving to several diverse households with various babysitters throughout my early childhood would leave the idea of stability and family absent from my mind. Lack of discipline and of consequences would make me disobedient to authority. This false sense of reality, the only reality I saw at the time, led to continuous school suspensions, no employment, and repeated police contact. Overall, an undesirable portrait of life. Having no intent to work, money was a necessity that I was willing to obtain by any means. On that summer day in July 2007, walking into a gift shop and holding the cashier at gunpoint, I was left with $800 in my pocket for 30 minutes and a cell with a metal bed for 2.5 years. This was the end of false knowledge playing its part and the beginning of reality stepping in. While serving my sentence in an environment where you are nothing more than a number in space, reality struck. I knew that the present me was not the real me. Reading books, obtaining my GED, taking college courses, and working for 50 cents an hour showed me responsibility and that there was still hope. Viewing and feeling the lack of freedom was a pain that fueled my blood to be a success and prove all those who doubted me that they were wrong, including myself. Coming home was a feeling nearly unexplainable and not believable for a long time, but I wasted not 1 minute. I found employment quickly, entered college, and began restoration into society day by day. My mindset was that of a positive person. Work hard, earn everything I achieve, with 105% effort put into it, have a family, and be viewed as a success while knowing how true that really is. Ultimately, being content and happy through my actions in life and knowing that I made it was and is my goal. It took all this time for me to realize that I've always wanted this feeling but never had the idea of what it was and how it was obtained. Through the necessary ordeal of prison, my viewpoint has been clarified and my knowledge vastly increased. The before was missing it, the present is making it, the future holds it, my American dream.
Advocates around the state are beginning to discuss the possibility of raising the age of criminal responsibility in New York. For those of you who are interested in learning more about this issue, go to the website of the New York Center for Juvenile Justice, Judge Corriero's organization. Other organizations involved in this issue statewide are the Institute for Juvenile Justice Reform and Alternatives, based in Brooklyn, the Correctional Association, and the Children's Defense Fund of New York, based in Manhattan, Youth Power, based in Albany, and the Center for Community Alternatives, based in Syracuse and Brooklyn.
That was produced by Alexandra Cox and Jeremy Thal. Special thanks. If you'd like to continue this conversation about juvenile justice, come tomorrow night, Friday, May 10th, 6:30 at 434 Columbia Street. Potluck at 6:30, 7 o'clock conversation about youth incarceration, juvenile justice, and restorative justice. You're listening to the Prison Voices Project. I'll put on a little music before closing us out. Get a pen and paper out. In the outro, you'll hear the address. If you have tips on what you'd like to hear, feedback on this show, please write down our address, send us a letter. We love to get mail. Thanks so much for tuning in. Listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I...
Roberto Gonzalez.
From Carroll.
From Carroll.
You're listening to.
You're listening to.
WGXC. Hands on Radio.
Hands on Radio.
For Greene and Columbia.
For Greene and Columbia.
Counties.
The Hunter Foundation makes grants available for first-time homebuyers purchasing an existing home in the town of Hunter. The Hunter Foundation is a nonprofit organization working to improve the hamlets and villages of Hunter. Call Annie at the Hunter Foundation for more information about the Home Ownership Grant Program. 518-589-5050, extension 10, or hunterfoundation.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, presenting an open house on Saturday, May 18th from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. at both Hudson and ACRA offices, with activities and demonstrations highlighting cooperative extension programs, events, and services. For more information, visit ccecolumbiagreen.org or call 828-3346 or 622-9820.
Night, babe, tears running down my cheeks. Went to bed last night, babe, with tears running down my cheeks. Got to thinking about my baby, I was crying in my sleep. Right here, babe, see way down in Jim Canal. I can sit right here, babe, see way down in Jim Canal. See the hoodoo women fixing up their monkey men. Early one morning, about the crack of day, it was early one morning, it'll go about the crack of day. Cried I seen that fella when he stole my babe away.
Nobody knows the trouble that I've seen. Nobody knows.